Welcome to the Storycraft Cafe. Come in, grab a cup of your favorite beverage, and get ready to join the storytelling conversation. Storycraft Cafe is brought to you by Dabble, the ultimate cloud-based fiction writing software. Here we're going to bring together storytellers from all walks to encourage and empower you to craft your best story. And we are live here in the Storycraft Cafe. I am your host, Hank Garner. Today, I am super excited to have Tom Werman on the show with me. He has an amazing new book. It's called Turn It Up, My Time Making Hit Records in the Glory Days of Rock Music. Tom, as someone who is, you know, a little north of 50 years old, born in the early 70s, and my music appreciation years really began in the late 70s and extend through the 80s when I was a teenager, and all those formative years. And reading through your book is like the soundtrack to my adolescence, and trip down memory lane it was for me. And what a fun experience to read some of the stories behind some of the records that were formative for my life. And so anyway, thank you for the contributions that you made to my upbringing, but also thank you for joining me today.
Yeah, well, it's nice to be here, and it was really a great pleasure to do the work, you can call it that. For me, it was the best job in the world. I couldn't bet. Imagine doing anything better.
I bet. Yeah. We always start the show with a fun question to kind of set the tone. And a question that I ask people all the time is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller? When did this bug bite you that you felt like you needed to gather your memories, put them on the page? What was the catalyst that got this going?
Well, I always enjoyed writing. I was a big complaint letter writer. I got a lot of good results from that, a lot of free samples. But with this book, I was doing a lot of podcasts.
Yeah.
About 10 years ago, they started to increase. The numbers started to increase. And I realized, I concluded that there was a lot of interest in classic rock, and that people of all ages seemed to want to know more about the music from the 70s and 80s. I did one podcast that got over 100,000 hits.
Wow.
And I said, well, I think this is, I think there are people out there who want to know how everything worked back then, the music that they love, how it was produced, how we found the artists, how we monetized the artists, promoted them, recorded them, and found them, especially. So I said, I at the same time, I was surfing the internet, and I found a very, very critical review of me, not of my records. And I was pretty irritated by this.
I bet.
So, yeah. So the podcast, and the guy, I'd never met the guy, and he got pretty personal. And so I wrote the editor of the blog, and I said, could I write a defense, please? And he said, sure, that'd be great. So I wrote my defense. I eviscerated the little guy. And then he said, our readers loved this. Would you write more for us? So I wrote 18 episodes about my career, which really provided a skeleton for the book. And then I put the meat on. I never wrote like the pros do. I never did the, you know, two cups of strong coffee at 6 a.m., 10 pages, no matter what.
Right.
I did not do that. I would get a recollection or a thought, and or I'd hear something that I wanted to talk about musically. And I'd write for 10 or 15, maybe 20 minutes, never longer than that. And sometimes I wouldn't write for a month. But when I felt like it, I would sit down and write. And then I would try to slot that writing into the work chronologically in the right place. And soon it became a book. And, yeah. and I continued and continued and continued. And if it weren't for the deadline, I'd still be writing. it's never, you know, I did discover that it's never finished.
Right.
And you really, when you turn it in, you're settling, you know, you're settling for the best you could do up to that time. But, it seems to be being received very well.
Yeah. Well, and the book we're talking about, as we mentioned earlier, is the new book Turn It Up, and it came out a couple of days before Thanksgiving. I think a week ago today, if I'm not mistaken. If you're listening to this live, let's talk about your history for just a second. You began as a musician yourself, not just a music producer. Is that right?
I'm sorry. Well, I began as a music
as a musician yourself, just a producer, right? So, what was it that initially drew you to music?
Oh my, Elvis! I would say Elvis was the first, impactful musical experience I had. I started listening to the radio with interest when I was about six or seven. This was the early 50s, and Mitch Miller and Patti Page and Pat Boone then Elvis in 1954, I think. That was the first record I ever bought, a single called Milk Cow Blues Boogie. And when I heard Hound Dog, that was it for me. There was just nothing like that in my life up to that point. And I started to lip sync and air guitar to Elvis for hours and hours. And I was a big, big, big Elvis fan. And I thought that his behavior and his movements and his whole demeanor overshadowed his talent. Quite a bit. He was a phenomenal singer, one of the greatest voices of that century, I think. I mean, his intonation was perfect. His pitch was perfect. The way he delivered a line. Anyway, I was hooked, and from then on, I just inhaled music, rock and roll music, and all kinds of music, really. But mainly rock and roll. And I taught myself how to play the guitar. And then I had a band. I had a little folk group in high school, a band in college. And then I made, sometimes I regret that I made a decision to pass up being a professional musician. Because we had a great band, and we had an offer to audition with Brian Epstein, who was the Beatles manager. And I turned it down and dutifully pursued a corporate career. And that was it. As I wrote in the book, I hated my job, and I lasted a year, and then I fled to rock and roll. Then it worked.
It's so funny. One of the first records that I remember was that 68 comeback special, the Elvis, and also Aloha Live from Hawaii. I remember my parents having that record as well, and Elvis being an ever-present you know, person in my house. And, you know, this before Elvis died. But that's so funny, you know, that he affected generations of people and, you know, a wide spectrum of listeners.
Yeah. The comeback thing that you mentioned, I think that was the Viva Las Vegas MGM movie.
Right.
Era for Elvis after he came back from the army.
Yeah, the black leather jumpsuit, I think, if I'm remembering 40 years ago, right?
I don't know, but there is another book that I really enjoyed. It's actually two volumes by Peter Gorelnik, it is everything you wanted to know and much more about Elvis. It's called Last Train to Memphis. And then the second volume is Careless Love, and they're split at his army career. Best music bio I've ever read.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow.
It's amazing. So when you went to work on the business side of the music business, how did you become a producer? Like, and I think, you know, when my big music consumption days, we would buy records. We would go to the record store and you would buy this 12-inch record, and there was a jacket, and you would read all about it. And if you were lucky, it was a gatefold and you could open it up and you could read all the lyrics, and there were maybe some stories in there and liner notes, and you would see produced by, always a byline there. And if you listened to enough music, especially in a particular era, you could pick up like, well, this sounds like a Tom Werman record, or whatever, but there were, and you would hear people say that, and you're like, well, what does that even mean? This sounds like a Tom Werman record. You know, like what, I guess a lot of people, and now that our music primarily comes from Spotify or something, you don't even see those credits and, you know, all of that. So, you know, back then you would look to see who all played on the record, and, you know, were there any guest musicians that came in, and who was the producer, and, you know, you wanted to read all the thank yous, and, you know, there, and invariably somebody would shout out in a thank you another artist, and then you would go find that artist and find out why it meant so much to this artist. And it was a whole, you know, the music discovery was a whole, you know, mystery, and we've lost a lot of that mystery now. But when, what is a record producer for people that don't understand the process? What role does a producer play?
Well, yeah, I didn't know anything about, I was that guy. I said, what does produced by mean? And, you know, first, most people, even today, think that a record producer is like a movie producer who gets the money together.
Funding, right. Project,
really. When I was finished with the record business and running our bed and breakfast, people would say, oh, you were in the record business. You were a producer? Which bands did you represent? And I said, no. It's really, the record producer is very much like a movie director. You are the musical director. So the deal is I listened to Who's Next and the Eagles' first record way back when. And I noticed that they were both produced by the same guy. And I was pretty impressed with that because I said, somehow this guy managed to do something really good with two diametrically opposed bands.
Right.
You know, on the musical spectrum. And one was bombastic and electric, and the other one was, you know, refined and acoustic. Anyway, it was Glyn Johns. And I said, I want to do what that guy is doing. So when I finally was able to sign Ted Nugent, and that's a long story. By the way, no politics involved. No politics. He went into the studio, but his contract was owned by a man who was entitled to produce him contractually. But I didn't feel that he had a real rock and roll mind. And so I wanted to protect my investment in Ted in order to keep my job, really. At that point, I was a talent scout, and I had tried to sign Kiss, Rush, and Lynyrd Skynyrd, and my boss passed on all of them. So eventually they understood.
If you would have landed them.
Yeah, really. Eventually they understood that I might know something that they don't. And so I was allowed to sign Ted. At that point, I needed to really hang my hat on something. So I went into the studio a lot to try to make sure that the record was, you know, coming along. And this is one of the things that an A&R man did. He shepherded the creative process. And I horned in so much, and I made so many suggestions that were adopted, that they gave me co-producer credit on the album, Ted and this guy who owned his production contract. And bang, I was a producer. You know, that overnight success was fairly common in the music business. You know, it was 1 week, what do you do? And the next week, you're beautiful, babe. We love you.
Right. So as you're working with a band, and you worked with so many, you know, gargantuan successes in the 70s and 80s, what role do you play? Like if a four man band comes into the studio and they have a vibe about them, they work together in a particular way and they have a particular sound, what role do you play in the record creating process?
Well, a good producer does everything. And from the very beginning to the very end, you know, the producer has a hand in every single decision, big or small. Ideally, a producer is supposed to suppress his own taste and help the band to realize its musical vision. But really, some of us didn't do that. I tried to make the songs better and make them better as far as I was concerned. So I would make a lot of suggestions and we would try them out, and usually they worked. If they didn't work, we wouldn't do them. But the producer meets the band, agrees to work with the band, ideally, picks the material with the band, maybe 14 or 15 songs, and you would eventually throw three or four away. Go into rehearsal. I'd listen to the demos a lot. You'd get all the songs. They would make a demo. Usually it was finished by the time you heard it. You heard the band. Then you do everything. I would make suggestions about changing the arrangement, changing maybe a cymbal from the ride cymbal to the hi-hat. I'd say, let's cut the intro in half and rearrange the song. We'd record it on a boombox in the rehearsal. We'd take the boombox with us into the studio and refer to this new version before we recorded the actual song. You set them up. You arrange where they are in the studio. You change the snare drum head. You change this mic. You get everything sounding the way you want it to, and then you start recording. And you guide them. You pick the best performances, and you build a kind of. I used to build a pyramid, starting with the drum track, and then we would overdub the bass, and then a double rhythm guitar, and so forth and so on, till you get to the pinnacle of the pyramid, which is usually the vocal, lead vocal, and some backing vocals, and then, you know, maybe percussion, and I would bring in a keyboard player, sing to him because I can't read or write music. And I'd, you know, kind of finish it off. Maybe the band had left for a tour by that time. And then you mix the record, which is the hardest part.
Yeah.
It can be the most enjoyable part. And then when you're finished mixing, I would always have the band, somebody from the band, approve the final mix. And then you master it, which is the last step. And they send parts to the studio, to the plant for pressing. And then you're on to your next project. So it really, there's a lot involved. But you know, some people just say they engineer a record and they call themselves producers. Some people are much more hands-off. But I was as hands-on as I could manage to be.
Yeah. I have 5 children. My oldest is 28 and my youngest is 19. And the oldest and youngest are both boys, and the 3 in the middle are girls. My oldest son, when he was in high school, would talk about music with his peers, and they would buy CDs and would wait for a new CD to come out. And, you know, this typical album cycle, you know, that they were kind of on the tail end, but still pursued music a lot similarly to the way I did. A lot of word of mouth, a lot of your friends, you know, turn you on to something, you go find it, a lot of that. My youngest son, who's 19 and in college right now, finds artists on TikTok.
Sure.
And then goes to Spotify and, you know, waits for them to drop a new song or whatever. And it is a completely different style that he is into. Lo-fi, you know, a lot of, you know, someone that's, you know, obviously sitting in their closet at home with a keyboard and, you know, making, you know, with a DAW on their computer and, you know, crafting whole, you know, songs in that way. And it's diametrically opposed, not the same music, not the way the music is made, not the way the music is promoted, completely different.
Yeah.
What do you make of the state of music today, and not just the industry side, but also kind of where music in general is? And then, you know, maybe talk about the difference in the business of music now.
I know so little about what they're doing now. And I even have a son who is in the A&R department at Warner Records in LA and, you know, a total music person.
Yeah.
And we, you know, he tries to explain to me how it works. And it's as hard for me to understand how the record business works as it is to understand how my new electric car works. I'm just kind of a tech idiot. We used to get demos on reel-to-reel tape or cassettes, and we'd listen to it. If we liked it, we'd fly out to see the band or go across town or whatever, you know, and then we'd go in and make records on magnetic tape, and people would buy them at the store. We listened to music when we made it. Now they seem to look at it because everything is on the screen and you can see the little graph, you know, and they can
form
this section and put it here in 1 second. And we would have taken it and cut the tape and spliced it in over here if we wanted to do something like that. They use algorithms. I don't even know what an algorithm is. They use social media to just gauge the popularity of an act. And I don't think I'd like it. I loved it back then, but it's just so different now that I just don't understand it. And as long as you're asking, I do channel my parents a lot by wanting to say, do you call that music? And
I know,
everything's perfect. Everything's computer. Well, a lot is computer generated.
Right.
They'll take one single snare hit, make it every snare
hit. Make it all the snare hits. Right.
Right. And there's something sterile and a little bit uninspiring about that. I listen to songs from 40 and 50 years ago, and I've been listening to them for 40 or 50 years, and they still work for me. I have a 4-hour playlist that I bring to the gym with me when I work out. And it inspires. There are songs there I've heard 500 times that inspire me. A young friend did make a contemporary short playlist for me, and I liked it very much in the beginning. After 2 or 3 weeks, it just didn't work for me anymore. I like to hear Warts and All. Yeah. I like human. There's something about human beings playing real instruments together. It makes a difference in the character of the music. You know, I walk into a pharmacy or a supermarket, and you know, it's hard. It's hard to listen to that caterwauling. The singers seem to want to fit as many notes as possible into one measure. I don't love it.
There's something to be said for the perfection of auto-tune and the snapping to if you've ever used Pro Tools, you can snap things to a measure, and it's precise. Right. And when real human musicians play and not to a click track, there's a certain swing that comes from, you know, a drummer that's just slightly off, but it's not off. There's a certain swing to it, and a guitarist that comes in a little behind the beat. And, you know, I mean, look at Willie Nelson. He's been coming in behind the beat for 50 years, you know, and, yeah, there's just something magical about humans making music.
And you can see it. The listener hears a variation of some kind, and he can imagine the artist. There's one Stone song that's live from Madison Square Garden on Get Your Ya-Ya's Out. And I think it's, I think it's Sympathy for the Devil. In the middle, at a certain point, you can hear Charlie Watts's snares on the bottom of his snare drum rattling from the vibrations of the bass.
Of the bass, right.
You know, and you see him. You see him in your mind, playing the drums, and you see the drum. These days, I just don't know what listeners imagine. They have to imagine the computer,
right?
Or if you're really computer savvy and you know how to play a keyboard, you can make records in your bedroom,
right?
And, you know,
and a lot of them are
great. Yeah, that's great in a way, but as you say, the perfection, I don't know, makes a big difference.
A little less human, I feel like yeah. I don't know. Yeah. Looking back, well, first off, when you started putting this book together, which, as you said, began as that series of blog posts where you were responding to someone, how did you go about collecting these stories? I mean, obviously they're in your head, but how do you go about recollecting them and kind of pulling out, well, you know, is this what happened with Ted Nugent, or, you know, like how do you trust your own memory? I think that's something that for people that write memoir is maybe one of the stickiest of situations. Well, this is the way I remember it.
That's
maybe
right.
They have a different story that they tell publicly. How do we find the truth of what actually happened?
Boy, it's tough, because they do. They are very good at historical revision.
Of course. Yeah.
And
everyone wants to be the star of their own story.
Well, yeah, or make you look bad. you know, I try to recall things as honestly and accurately as possible. But 20 years down the, or 40 years down the line after the record was made and They Love You and they had a platinum record, sold millions of records, you sucked. Right. You know, 40 years later, you just weren't, you know, you didn't do well at all. You didn't listen. You didn't pay attention. They had to do stuff. And oh, I mean, the historical revision is stunning. And, you know, you kind of get used to it. I've never heard an artist praise his producer or their producer, you know, decades later. Maybe the Beatles, you know. But it's really disappointing how they do that. You know, there are things that I remember that stood out, and I put those in the book. I checked with a friend who's encyclopedic in his recollections, you know, to fact check a little bit. I wrote what I remembered. It's not easy, and I tried to concentrate on the positive. You know, yeah. Instead of the kiss and tell method, there were plenty of really negative things that I could have written about.
Sure. I mean, we're talking about the excess of the 70s and 80s. I'm sure there was lots of negative that could have been dragged out into the sunlight.
Some of it's in there. You know, I think the longest chapter is the one about cocaine. But it was fun to write, though.
Sure.
I was there.
Do you think that some of those cultural touchstones, the cocaine, for instance, that you mentioned, there seem to be certain substances that were prevalent in certain decades? And I've heard someone else talk about that, well, this decade sounds like the 60s sound like LSD and the 70s sound like marijuana and the 80s sound like cocaine. Is that a, I mean, you were there, you had a front row seat for it. Is that a fair thing to say?
Well, the 80s is, that's for sure. Because as far as I could see, Los Angeles fairly ran on cocaine, and not just the music business, you know, doctors, lawyers, judges, cops. Wow. You know, it was a very, everybody thought it was a delightful little harmless party favor, and it turned out to be something else. But when I was in college, you know, a new Beatles record would come out, you would get high and listen to it because it was a fabulous experience. You know, and then in the 70s, I guess, you know, it was weed. And then about 1975, cocaine made its entrance, you know, into the culture. And then everyone seemed to have cleaned up in the early 90s or just disparaged the drug culture. And I suppose I know it's still around. Cocaine is still around, but it, you know, it definitely influenced a lot of people in a lot of different pursuits in those days.
Do you have an artist or a band that you worked with that you have nothing but fond memories of working with them? They were a pleasure to work with. They worked with you to make the best product that they could. Do you have recollections like that?
Yeah, I have to say that my best work as a producer and the most enjoyable project were three albums I did with Cheap Trick. I thought they were a brilliant band. Each one was
classic albums,
superb at his instrument or voice. They'd work very quickly. They were very good and very funny and very bright. And I just had a ball working with them. And there were others that were very pleasant to work with, but none quite as good as that. I would wake up and just hurry to the studio. I was just really happy to work with them, and it was a great time. I think they should have been much bigger than they were or are.
Yeah. One thing that anyone who's been following the book industry for the last decade or two decades is that what seems to happen in the book industry happened in the music industry about a decade before. And we're starting to see a lot of the shifts in the book publishing and book sales industry that the record industry went through. Advent of digital books was a big kind of upheaval in the last decade, and with ebooks and Kindles and all of that, very much so like what happened with music streaming. And now you've got the advent of AI that's starting to rear its head in the music business and in the publishing business, and has people all in a tizzy. What do you see? I mean, first off, the music business is where your specialty lies. Do you see a future for music and maybe rock and roll specifically? Can it survive all of the technology that's inserting itself?
I think classic rock is a finite era. It's over. There's not a whole lot of guitar in today's pop music. And I don't think that we're going to see a return to analog magnetic tape live recording. Who knows where music will be in 20 or 30 years? I don't really want to think about it, because I'm not wild about the direction that it has taken or is taking now. Just the way we listen or experience music. If when I was 10 years old, if I told my friends that in our lifetime we wouldn't buy records anymore, they'd be stored in the air and we would rent them, listen to them, and then they'd go back to their storage space in the cloud, they'd say, what are you, nuts? I mean, nobody, that album experience that you described, that was great. And they don't have it now. I don't think they miss it, because I don't think they know too much about what it is. My son is a collector and a trader. You know, he buys rare records and he sells them at a profit. So he understands the album culture, but I think a lot of people don't, who are just listeners, but they're not that passionate about the collecting, the history. I don't think we're ever going to see a profusion of incredibly creative music like we did in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, especially the 60s and 70s.
Yeah. What's interesting is you can turn on country radio these days and you can hear a song that you say, I could have heard this on the top 40 pop rock station in the 80s, and this would have played exactly, it would have fit exactly in there. And now that's country music. That's considered, your middle-aged mom's music. It's funny to see these trends and how they kind of float through the landscape of commerce. It's fascinating to watch.
The middle-aged mom thing is it's interesting in that whole families are now classic rock fans. Yeah. I saw a teenage girl in the gym with an Iron Maiden t-shirt. And I went up to her and I said, listen, I have to ask you how you learned about this band, because when they were popular, you weren't born.
Right.
And she said, well, my dad, you know, he really likes this kind of music and he played it all the time. So we listen
to it by osmosis.
We like it. And that's, I think that's why the age range of fans of classic rock is so big, you know, because we were there. And then the people behind us in that generation, my kids listened, you know, were teenagers when I was doing most of my work. And then their kids, and so it goes.
Well, speaking of bands like Iron Maiden, they're having some of the biggest tours of their career now, and they're all in their 60s. I mean, they're drawing crowds bigger than they did in the 80s. It's wild.
Yeah.
So, you know, while the recording industry side of this, you know, may be gone forever, that there's something people are still wanting to latch on to, this live experience. At least we have that.
Yeah. Yeah. There have been a number of farewell tours.
Yeah. That extend into eternity.
Actually, by the same band.
Right.
You know, I mean, Motley Crue even made a big deal out of signing a contract saying, this is it. We promise we'll break up and you can really nail us if we get back together again.
Yeah. So, and here they are.
I don't think I think part of that is that rock stars don't know the meaning of downsize.
Right.
You know, their phenomenal income stream kind of shrinks or dries up a little bit later in life, and they're used to a certain lifestyle, and they say, well, yeah, we can make a whole lot of money now.
Yeah, they
can make so much money.
Right.
On the road, it's just astonishing. I mean, this Taylor Swift business. I saw the Beatles at Carnegie Hall for $7.50. And I saw the Stones first show in New York for $5. And now I think the algorithm that determined Springsteen ticket prices last year, I think it was Live Nation that did it. Whether they wanted to or not, they wound up with a $5,000 highest price ticket. $5,000. I mean, they fixed it, but that's how the algorithm, you know, determined what the cost of the highest price ticket would be. I don't know.
But,
you know, there are you know, bands like Motley Crue, Twisted Sister, things like that. They can have a meet and greet ticket.
Yeah.
You know, that sells for $1,500. It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Wow. Yeah. So you write the book, you collect all these stories that you had been gathering for a while. What was the process like to get this book out when you kind of had a vision for what, you know, when you're writing a memoir, there's a certain window that you're portraying in the book. You know, an autobiography is kind of from cradle to grave, you think of, but a memoir is usually a window in time that you're looking. How did you present the book? How did you find a publisher? And what was the experience like getting to this point, you know, from working at your desk to now, you know, the full published product?
Well, I learned a lot about, I researched how to prepare a proposal, how to write a proposal, because I was kind of, I realized that you needed a proposal to approach a publisher, but I didn't realize that there was an agent step in between you and the publisher, and I didn't realize how complex the creation of a proposal was, if you want to do it right. So there's a fiction proposal and a nonfiction proposal. There's a format. And I wasn't really happy about having to conform to a model, you know, and I thought my proposal wound up being really long. And it had chapter summaries. And there are 30 something chapters in the book, and some very short, some not so short, but I summarized each chapter, and it probably took 10 minutes to read my proposal. But that's the way it turned out. And I went online and looked at, tried to find agents for music books. And I compiled a list and I sent the proposal out to about 10 agents, the ones who seemed to do more music books or more entertainment books. I got 10 rejections, nice ones. And the last one of those rejections said, "I don't do this, but I think you should try this guy." And so I immediately sent the proposal to that guy. And 15 minutes later, I got a message back from him saying, "This is right up my alley."
Oh, wow.
And that, and I said, "Oh my God, I have an agent." suggested a few things after he had seen some of the text, and I cooperated. You know, I did what he told me I should do, and then he sent the proposal to about 10 publishers, and they all of them asked for the text, and I thought I was going to get a couple of major people. I had Zoom meetings with them. They were very enthusiastic and complimentary, but they passed ultimately. The publisher that I wound up with, Jawbone, the Jawbone Press, they're in London, and they exclusively publish pop culture and music books. Yeah. And they liked it right away, and they expressed their interest, and the agent, who is Lee Sobel, he had worked with them before, and he had a good things to say about them, so there we are. My editor was really, really good, Tom Seabrook, and he was really hands off. He made some suggestions. He had me get rid of one chapter that he didn't feel was, you know, essential to the book. But basically, the book is pretty much the same as it was when I turned it in to him. That was it. I was really lucky. You know, I know it's hard to get a book published, really hard. Yeah. And I hadn't expected to. And I also, I have to admit that I wasn't crazy about the concept of self-publishing. I wanted the credibility. I wanted the book to be published by someone, because it's a stamp of approval of some kind, you know, yeah. So that people say, "Oh, I see this was published by a real publisher." So. It must be decent anyway. So that's it. And then bang, here we are.
Your trip through publishing, was there a person in the process that seemed to be like the producer? Is there a role in publishing that correlates to the music industry? Like, in your mind, is an editor like a producer?
He is. Mine was. You know, he was involved in the cover art. He was involved in the endorsements. You know, advice. and you know, and opinion and guidance. So yeah, without him, it just wouldn't have taken shape the way it did. Everything about it is good, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, it's not like a movie script, or you know, if they option a book for a movie. I've heard nightmare stories about, you know, they're entitled to do whatever they want, basically, you know, and they're not going to mangle a Tom Clancy or a Robert Ludlum, but I've heard stories about, you know, writers who just throw their hands up and say, they ruined my book.
Yeah.
Now mine was barely, you know, barely amended. I think people are, from what I've gotten for feedback, I think people are pretty surprised that a hard rock record producer can write a sentence. you know, I've always enjoyed writing, and I'm a grammar nit. I'm very upset about the erosion of the English language. And I learned in high school English. I went to a private school, and I had an English teacher who became who went to the English faculty and at Harvard. And we knew the rules. I mean, there are rules. I know language evolves, but boy, it's getting English language is getting destroyed, I like to write. I've written a lot, but this is my first book, and I actually have another one in mind, but it's not musical.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Turn It Up, which is available everywhere now. You can go grab it at your local bookstore. We'll put links in the show notes where you can grab it from Amazon if you don't have a great local bookstore. But is this the definitive word on your music career, or are there more stories yet to come, Tom? We need to know.
Well, there's one complaining chapter toward the back called A Rant. There are stories that there are more stories, but not many that are worth telling. I mean, this, as you say, is probably the definitive, recollection of or story of my career. What I think people find interesting is how I got into it. And then a little bit about how I reinvented myself when I was finished, you know. They seem to like it, and I think that I've put most of the interesting stuff in my life in there. I didn't want it to be an autobiography. It's autobiographical in that it explains how I couldn't avoid a career in music and how music ruled my life. But that's about it. I didn't want it to be, and I did this, and then I did this, and then I did this. I think it's inspiring to people who are not happy with what they're doing. You know, follow your dream kind of thing.
Yeah.
I hope it is anyway. Because I almost spent my life in virtual chains. With the MBA and the corporate life that my parents prepared me for. I think one of the interesting chapters is an early one called The Burden of Privilege.
Yeah.
Which is a little departure from the rock and roll business, but it explains why I made a misstep and went in the wrong direction before I fixed things up.
Yeah. Well, if you're interested in the music of our recent past, or one man's journey through the machine that made it all happen, Turn It Up is a must have for your bookshelf. Go grab it today. Visit your local bookstore, like we said, or we'll put links in the show notes where you can grab it from Amazon. Tom, if people, is there a place online where people can connect with you and, you know, share their stories with you, or, you know, follow along for any other news of further adventures to come?
Well, you know, I'm a stranger to social media. I do have a website, and I'm not even sure what the URL is.
We'll link it in the show notes so people can click it and
good find it. I'd be happy to communicate with anybody who wants to contact me.
Wonderful. Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes as well. Tom Werman, this has been so fun chatting. Thank you for taking time to come on, share your stories, and thank you for this amazing book. We're going to recommend everyone go grab a copy. And Christmas season is coming up. Grab a handful of them and use them for stocking stuffers for the music lovers in your life. Tom, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
And thank you, Hank, for having me and for making it a really interesting conversation.
That's our episode for today. There's so much more to come as we talk with authors about the craft of writing, but also the business of publishing. Be sure to subscribe to the Storycraft Cafe podcast in your favorite podcast app to never miss an episode. The Storycraft Cafe is made possible by Dabble. Writing a book is challenging. Your writing tool shouldn't be. Dabble is an easy-to-use online writing tool packed with helpful features that allow beginning novelists and published authors to create amazing stories. Visit us at dabblewriter.com and start your free trial. Thanks for listening.